Good morning, everyone, or at least morning in the U.S., and welcome to Outlook 2021 for Emerging Markets in Sovereign and Corporate Debt. I'm Steve Abrahams, Head of Investment Strategy for Amherst Pierpont. The last year has definitely packed plenty of surprises. If you predicted them all, then you have a world-beating crystal ball. But get ready for more in 2021. Pandemic has definitely changed the economy, true in the U.S. and around the world. The Fed and central bank intervention has changed markets, again, true in the U.S. and around the world. And arguably, for the first time since the 2008 financial crisis, government has jumped into the mix, and fiscal policies have had just tremendous impact. Today, we want to spend the bulk of an hour focusing on the aftershocks of all of these things. In markets, I'll outline five major investment themes likely to shape markets and returns next year. In the economy, Stephen Stanley, our chief economist, will point to ways that the economy could confound consensus. In emerging markets sovereign debt, Siobhan Morden will look at the interplay between growth, sovereign debt load, and liquidity and try to find opportunity. And in EM corporate debt, Jose Klicksberg will find spots where portfolios can outperform next year. You'll notice that you have a chat feature on the right side of your webinar screen. You can use that to ask questions at any point in the presentation. So when they're fresh, take advantage. But we're going to save them until we get through our initial remarks, and then we'll open the call to those questions and any other questions that might come during the Q&A period. So let's get started. So on to markets. There really are five things that are likely to surprise the market next year and create opportunity for portfolios broadly to outperform. First, the yield curve, which should steepen a lot more and a lot faster than forward rates imply. Right now, forward rates imply the slope of the yield curve, at least in the U.S., will barely change over the next year. The spread between 2-year and 10-year yields, for example, is now in the neighborhood, of about 80 basis points. A year from now, the market prices in only something slightly steeper, less than 10 basis points steeper than where we are today, and that seems far too little. Two things are likely to make that slope larger. First, on the short end, the Fed and flexible average inflation targeting, the new framework the Fed introduced at Jackson Hole. That really will have the Fed pinning down the front end of the curve far longer than the Fed may have in the past. The Fed is willing to let unemployment go quite low. The Fed is willing to let inflation run hot, and they're willing to keep the front end highly accommodative while all of that is unfolding. On the long end, we have pandemic recovery, which Stephen Stanley will describe in more detail, likely to lift growth far faster than consensus. We have, as I mentioned, a very accommodative Fed, including QE, and we have the possibility in the U.S. of fiscal stimulus, both in response to pandemic and also from infrastructure and other new policies of a new administration. We've already seen implied break-even inflation in the U.S. rise from the 170s to the 190s over the last few weeks, and that should continue to drive longer yields up. So the rates trades in the U.S. and arguably in other parts of the world are curve steepeners, or alternatively, more exposure to the short end than to the long end of the curve. Secondly, lower-rated credits should outperform higher-rated credits. Again, the Fed and the economy are in play on this one. With the Fed, this is really all about QE. QE absorbs safe assets, and the Fed is buying treasuries and agency MBS, and that has been steadily squeezing investors into risk one or two or three tiers higher than normal. Beyond that, lower rated credits are much more levered to the economy than higher rated credits. In fact, the lower the credit, the greater the impact of small changes in growth and income. Just think about debt service coverage or interest coverage ratios. So there's a little bit of risk here. The rollout of the vaccines has a lot of logistical challenges, but we strongly feel that by the end of 2021, at the latest, we are going to be well on our way to renormalization. So the trades there are really straightforward. High yield should outperform IG. IG should outperform safer products, and that's a great way of allocating for the year ahead. Third idea is private debt. Many portfolios may not be aware of the private debt markets, since I think most of us focus on the publics, but this hinges on what banks do traditionally in the U.S., which is tighten in bad times and loosen in good. You can look at the Senior Loan Officer's Opinion Survey, and the pattern is there very clearly. Banks tightened sharply in 2020, basically back to the same levels they tightened in 2008, and echoing tightening in after the bursting of the internet bubble in 2001. That leaves behind fundamentally good, creditworthy borrowers that need to go to the private markets for lending. They have been getting private loans. They are likely to continue getting private loans in 2021, and those private loans are likely to be much better than average. So direct private lenders should do well, and also portfolios that finance direct lenders should do well. For institutional portfolios, a classic way to do that would be in broadly syndicated loan CLOs, middle market CLOs, and then there's a wide range of other opportunities to finance corporate debt and other forms of private consumer debt. We think that's going to be a very useful place to be this year. Fourth idea is really opportunities in niche platforms, best-in-class niche platforms that should do well. And this really has everything to do with the advantages of size and the benefit that comes along with that, a lower cost of capital. The Fed's decision to buy IG debt this year has really created policy value in an investment-grade balance sheet. And that means, going forward, a lower cost of debt and equity to some degree because of the potential for the Fed to come in and backstop systemically that part of the market. We've seen it in spreads, where the highest quality IG is now tighter than pre-COVID levels, with lower credits substantially wider. So the interesting portfolio position here is really to own not necessarily the larger acquiring platforms, but the best-in-class niche players that are likely to become the targets of acquisition bids. The debt of these platforms will find itself suddenly taken into larger balance sheets with much better sources of funds and a lower cost of equity, and that should lift the value of the debt issued by these smaller niche players. And finally, the last investment theme, returns to informationally intensive assets should run above average. Here again, the idea focuses on what pandemic has done to the chain of information. It's really broken it into smaller parts. People are working from home. There's social distance between parties. So we have lost not the information that goes into databases. There's plenty of that on the internet and elsewhere. But what we've lost are the intangibles that are so important in complex decisions. A sense of preferences, priorities, impressions, levels of trust, and where portfolios can do the hard work of getting this kind of information, it should pay in above market returns. The way to take advantage of that is in complex structures or leveraged balance sheets, deep credit, private transactions, and other sorts of portfolio positions that require the collection and analysis of data and the important intangibles that go with it. So, five investment themes that we believe will have impact across a wide range of markets, including EM. Now let's turn to the economy, where our chief economist, Stephen Stanley, has been looking for places where the path next year could really upend consensus, and he'll walk us through what some of those might be. Stephen?
Thanks, Steve, and hello, everyone. So I'll start by talking just briefly about what the consensus forecast for 2021 looks like. And I would say, in general, economists' forecasts for the year ahead tend to be pretty vanilla, and that is really the case in 2021, despite all the craziness that we've seen in the economy over the past year. If you look at last month's Bloomberg survey of economists, the median forecast for real GDP growth in the four quarters of 2021 would be 3.1, 3.3, 3.2, and 3.2. So call it steady growth at a pace that I would characterize as mildly above trend, and, you know, frankly, not making up a lot of the gap that would have, the hole that we've created for ourselves in 2020. Similarly, the unemployment rate is slowly falling in the consensus forecast over the course of 2021 by a few tenths of a percentage point each quarter, but still remains elevated. It gets down to just below 6% by the end of next year. And then inflation, there'll be some volatility in the year-over-year numbers through the first half of the year, but once you get into the second half of the year and things settle out, the consensus looks for year-over-year advances in PCE inflation, both headline and core, to be running around 1.75%, so just a small amount below the Fed's 2% target. So that's our consensus against which I would benchmark my own thoughts, and now I'll give you three out-of-consensus risks that I think are worth considering for the year ahead. The first one is the possibility that we get a near-complete economic recovery from COVID. I think, you know, certainly the news over the last month or so has been very good in terms of vaccines as well as treatments. And it's my view that there's a good chance that we can return to something closer to normal in the U.S. economy by, you know, call it the middle of the year or perhaps sometime in the summer. And the result of that is obviously that you would get a strong rebound, particularly in the categories of the economy where things right now are held back severely, categories like restaurants and retailers, hair and nail salons, amusement parks, spectator events, things like that, and travel, of course. If those types of activities are allowed to fully reopen, then I would anticipate that the economy would do better than the consensus, and in particular that you might see a period of time, you know, again, maybe it's summer or into the fall, when you get a burst of activity, kind of a nonlinear increase in GDP growth. And, you know, the last bit of that I would point to as well is the education sector, which not only has implications for GDP directly, but is very important indirectly because it allows people who right now maybe have to stay at home to care for their kids to get back into the labor market. You know, I'd anticipate there's a good chance that the 2021-22 academic year can start on time and fully in person in the fall if vaccines are ramped up and the pandemic is brought under control. So the second risk is really tied to that, which is looking particularly at the labor market. And as I mentioned before, the consensus view is that the labor market is still going to be considerably softer by the end of next year than what we saw going into the pandemic when the unemployment rate was at a 50-year low. I think there's a chance that we get back to something pretty close to what the Fed would consider to be full employment by the end of next year if these sectors of the economy that right now are, you know, to one degree or another closed are able to reopen. So if you look at the roughly 10 million jobs that we've lost on balance since February, about 7 million of them are in sectors that are being held down to one degree or another by government-imposed social distancing rules, whether it be restaurants, education, hotels, amusement parks, etc. So if the economy is able to reopen in something approaching normal, then I think the labor market probably recovers to a greater extent than anticipated. You might see a downward swing in the unemployment rate in the middle of the year and into the fall. And I think by the end of the year, you could see unemployment as low as 4% in that scenario. And then my third risk that I think is worth thinking about is inflation. And here, it's really more a forecast of uncertainty rather than a strong view one way or the other. The Fed seems very confident that inflation is going to remain benign for several more years. Their view is primarily predicated on the idea that the unemployment rate is going to be high and that that's going to be putting downward pressure on inflation. And, you know, there are reasons to question that, as I just discussed, but even if you accept that, I think there are also a lot of potentially offsetting forces pushing inflation higher. There are a lot of categories where prices fell because of the lack of demand due to the restrictions. So, you know, you could see a sharp rebound in a number of categories, whether it be, motor vehicle prices, airfares and hotels, you know, a lot of the things that have been affected by the pandemic directly. On top of that, it's very possible that the entire cost structure of the economy is raised to some degree. Firms are having to restructure their physical facilities, whether it be manufacturers having to socially distance their factory floors. I think a lot of businesses are going to have to spend more on cleaning and other things even after the pandemic is over. And then labor costs have risen, and at some point, as demand companies may feel like they need to try to recoup those increased costs. And then finally, energy prices could be have an upward impetus on inflation. We know that oil prices fell sharply during the lockdowns. They've recovered partially, but remain quite a bit lower than what, you know, had been the norm prior to the pandemic. And so if we do get back to a higher level of economic activity, more travel, et cetera, then oil prices could rise, which, of course, would have a direct effect on the headline inflation numbers, but could also indirectly bleed over into the core. So I don't have a tremendously strong conviction on inflation in 2021. I think there is a good chance that it does exceed 2%. But I think the bigger issue is that I just think that the high level of confidence that the Fed has on the downside with regard to inflation to me seems somewhat questionable. And so I think as an investor, it would probably pay to kind of have an open mind and be prepared for surprises on either side with regard to inflation in 2021. And with that, I will hand it back to Steve.
All right. Thanks very much, Stephen. Let's jump into the real meat of the EM presentation today and go to Siobhan Morden, get Siobhan your views on where we should be on the sovereign side of the equation.
Great. Thanks, Steve. Can you go to the next slide, slide five? Great. So we have a very bullish external view, as you've just heard from our team. And how does this imply, what does this mean for a sovereign credit strategy in LATAM? So clearly, with demand for high yield, with global trend of negative rates, I should like everything that's high yielding. That's not the case. I'm much more cautious in terms of liquidity and solvency risks. And if you look at the normalization of yields that we've had across IG credits, you can clearly see that the single B LATAM credits have yet to normalize. My top pick amongst the high yielders is El Salvador. Local currency is also a popular investment theme on expectations of a weak dollar and also capital inflows. And in that context, my top pick are the Uruguay Global Linkers. Next slide, please, Steve. So RG and Ecuador are not carry trades. They have near zero coupons. so they should not correlate with external risk. Instead, these two credits should correlate with or should be driven more by idiosyncratic risk. And effectively, whether you're long these two credits, it's a view on whether there's optionality for policies that can improve debt solvency. So bondholders have already provided liquidity risk, so really it's a question of price appreciation, whether that's possible on improving the solvency indicators. The carry trades focus on Costa Rica and El Salvador, and that's going to depend upon access to liquidity and preferably under IMF programs such that there's prospects for fiscal discipline and economic reform that could improve solvency indicators and hence allow for price appreciation on the Eurobond. Next slide, please, Steve. So this excess global liquidity and negative yields do not imply liquidity for all credits. If you look at some of the slides I show here, there's clearly been a hit to both liquidity ratios in terms of fiscal data, a hit to ratings, credit ratings, a hit to debt ratios, and also a slow recovery in terms of trend growth. Next slide, please. So in terms of whether these countries can tackle the solvency issues and the solvency overhang is really going to be a question of the strength of execution risk and the popularity and support and strength of the leadership of these countries, and also the extent of the economic recoveries. I think the inconsistency that we have in Latin America is you have the solvency overhang for some of these credits where IMF is a lender of last resort and the only available credit, then there's going to be an effort to improve solvency ratios. But the contradiction is the timing is inopportune in terms of the extent of or the slow economic recovery. Also, there's election constraints or ideological constraints. That's more the case for Argentina. But if we look at Ecuador as a preview as one of the credits that now has an IMF program, the IMF requires ambitious adjustment to 5% of GDP. Or if you look at Costa Rica, who's trying to negotiate an IMF program, there's going to be difficult on execution risk. So these credits, these weaker credits are quite fluid. We have to be very careful in terms of asset selection, and it's going to be difficult to really forecast the year ahead. But let me start with the highest yielding credit, Argentina. So Argentina is my least favorite. Every day I come in, I look at FX reserves, and we're either making new lows or at the lows. And in terms of Eurobond holders, in terms of the future for debt repayment capacity, we really need to see FX reserve accumulation. The IMF came and went. I still think there's going to be an IMF program. That's a consensus view. But I only view it as a political compromise. The main problem in Argentina is ideology. And given their policies focused on public consumption growth model, a closed economy, it's driven to a current status of a balance of payments crisis. So the fix for a balance of payments crisis is typical recipe of lower spending, higher interest rates, FX flex. And as of a few weeks ago, given the failure of the policies under Guzman, I was thinking, well, listen, if we have a crisis, hopefully we'll get a turnover in the economic team, we'll shift back to orthodoxy. That's no longer the case. Guzman has introduced some piecemeal, what I call piecemeal pragmatism, kind of muddling through, preventing a worse crisis, but not quite stabilizing the economy. And so when I look at future debt payment, I really need to see reserves start to accumulate. We have negative reserves of $2 billion if you look at the narrowest measure of liquid reserves, and we have gross reserves at $38 billion. If you refer back to the DSA metrics that they released back earlier this year, they were expecting reserves, gross reserves, to be $50 billion the end of this year and $64 billion when the time amortizations start to commence in 2024. So when I struggle with Argentina, I say to myself, how are they going to accumulate $27 billion of reserves over the next couple of years? And there's been two episodes of reserve accumulation. It was a commodity boom during the early years of Kirchnerismo, and it was a capital inflows during Macri. And none of those conditions exist now. So we need either a positive shock to sentiment with the right policy mix or a positive external shock. And neither of those seem imminent at the moment, so that reaffirms still my bearish view on Argentina. Shifting to Ecuador. Ecuador, I'm neutral. I think if I'm looking at current yields, it reflects my views of political and policy risks post-elections. I have to admit, I'm getting a little bit negative with the rally that we've seen over the past couple of days, because when I look at current yields and referencing the 40s here, and we're almost like a 10% yield, I try to back out what does that imply in terms of the election outcome and the policy risk post-election. So if we assume that a Lasso win would imply an 8% yield and an Arauz win a 14% yield, current yields on 40s kind of say 60-40 kind of mix. But if we're looking at the recent radical statements from Arauz and references to his views on de-dollarization and Chavez-type policies and support for Chavez, maybe yield should be closer to 15%. So that would shift odds closer to a 70% win for Lasso, which I think is optimistic at this stage. There's a lot of uncertainty in the polls. We don't know whether it's going to be a runoff round or a first round win, but given the last few polls, it doesn't look like Lasso has the momentum for a 40% win. So it could look like a tight runoff round. And given the stakes of an Arauz victory, a kind of a worst case scenario of an Arauz victory, clearly that could create some nervousness. The benefit for Lasso would be less budget stress and economic recovery. We're seeing that, but I am a little concerned about the delays in terms of approving the anti-corruption bill, which is a prerequisite for the disbursement of $2 billion of IMF loans this December 15th. If there is liquidity stress, it could create a populist backlash, and that is the main concern for Ecuador. I do assume that Lasso will win. It's hard to have conviction on that view at this stage of the election cycle. If Lasso does win, I do think that there is optimism in terms of policy risk post-election. There is really no alternative to an IMF program in Ecuador. The Moreno administration maybe came in with center-left views, but with the constraints of dollarization, learned very quickly that he had to deliver pragmatism as a prerequisite to access external credit. If you cannot access external credit, it's forced adjustment, and that's probably a worse trade-off. So there's been a lot of election rhetoric from Lasso, what he can or cannot do, or whether he rejects or embraces tax hikes. I think for now it is rhetoric, but post-elections, the constraints of dollarization, the popularity of dollarization will force Lasso to have a pragmatic stance. But there does need to be more awareness in Ecuador about what's necessary to defend dollarization. And it is worrisome that we can't get this. There's been delays on this anti-corruption bill, and there's probably about 25% core support for candidates like Arauz and Perez, which to me is incredible. For a country that wants dollarization, you have to accept fiscal discipline. That's the trade-off, and economic reform. So that's going to be the next stage of debate, and a reminder that Ecuador is a credit that evolves in stages. So again, neutral in the credit now. I'm a little bit nervous as prices have run up here, given that still the uncertainty on the elections and post-election policy risk. So shifting now to what are kind of the carry trades, the Costa Ricas and the El Salvadors. With Costa Rica, we've had a nice run-up in yields, or I should say prices and lower yields. And part of it was the announcement that, yes, IMF talks are back on. Although I think words are cheap, we still don't have a path towards an IMF program. And that's really the trade for Costa Rica and El Salvador, is can they source sufficient liquidity, and will there be commitment for a difficult IMF program? In Costa Rica, if we assume that an IMF program and what the IMF requires is too difficult, does Costa Rica have enough local liquidity to fund itself? Next year, it's going to be very difficult. They have funding needs of 15% of GDP. I've been encouraged, or I should say less pessimistic, because since they kind of broke off talks or suggested that there would be talks with the IMF in early October, they have been able to fund themselves. And that's a case where maybe these positive externals spill over to local markets and maybe local sentiment will remain strong. I looked at the risk of saturation in local markets in Costa Rica. And if you look at their structural deficit for the past 10 years, they have been running huge and increasing structural fiscal deficits, and they've still been able to fund themselves. So there is depth of the local market. So I think the questions then shift to the willingness to fund if there isn't an IMF program. I think the role of the central bank has been important. There's Costa Rica is not a situation of saying external or balance of payment stress. They still have a comfortable cushion of FX reserves in terms of liquidity, around 15% of GDP. And the central bank has taken an interesting role, not really necessarily in terms of QE, but in terms of intervening in the FX market, reducing some of that stress so we don't have a negative spillover in terms of the treasury and the auction risk. And I think that role has been important. So for locals, if there is no IMF program, if we go into next year and there's still no progress or commitment for an IMF program, and there's an increasing talk about domestic debt restructuring or forced NPV losses, will the locals continue to fund the Treasury? That's really the question. And will they be willing to fund into insolvency? If they're willing to fund into insolvency, then liquidity doesn't become insolvency, and maybe Costa Rica is able to muddle through. But that's really the main questions going into next year. I'm still quite cautious on this credit, but I am less pessimistic knowing that they've been able to fund themselves since October, and the rollover risk hasn't been as worrisome as I initially thought. But I am still concerned about potential mark-to-market risk under the context of no IMF program and the commitment of the locals to continue to fund the government. I believe there's better risk reward for El Salvador. El Salvador has a Bukele risk premium, and I understand that. But I don't think the market truly appreciates that there is some budget flex, meaning structural spending is low. And under dollarization, if you look at the data since October, specifically in October, when there is no inflow of external credit, when they don't have access to a loan or a multilateral loan or specific local financing, they don't spend. So there was a reduction in spending in October, and there's been a full recovery in tax collection, even VAT, over the past couple of months. So that's given the budget some flexibility. If you look at the local debt, it has been manageable. It has been it's relatively low this month. It spikes early next year, but they have been able to roll themselves over. So I look at El Salvador as better risk reward in terms of lower vol, higher carry trade, and that potential price appreciation is a positive shock of an IMF program next year. I don't see many alternatives other than El Salvador formalizing an IMF program. They have an underfunded budget next year of around $1 billion, and their domestic markets are quite shallow. So being a dollarized country, you have a couple options. You can have pragmatic policies that allow you to access external credit, and we've seen this in Ecuador, or you know, you can choose heterodox policies that backlash into economic crisis. So those are really the two options. The fact that this economic team has had consistent negotiations and talks with the IMF informally, I think they are aware of those risks. So I do think the dollarization, and I look at a lot of parallels to Ecuador here, forces some responsibility amongst politicians. And so El Salvador has been our top pick since we published last year, the year ahead, and continues to outperform into this month. And then finally, focusing on Uruguay linkers, that has been my secular favorite trade. The returns have not disappointed since they issued a new benchmark linker last July. Real yields have compressed from 4% to 2.7% on the 40s. Current levels are still the highest linkers in the region next to Brazil. But I think more importantly, they deliver that high inflation income that allows for that double-digit passive return. It's also the context of a weak dollar trade this year, and LATAM potentially could be beneficiary of capital inflows. I think that also supports Uruguay. Uruguay benefits from the strongest fundamentals in the region. It was a top credit this year in terms of dollar returns, and I expect one of the quickest economic recoveries in Uruguay. Still strong FDI, and we have a reformist new government. So from a credit perspective, this is a country that is improving. Unfortunately, we still have structural problems that contribute to high inflation income, but that's an opportunity in terms of that passive carry for local investors. And on a relative value basis, I think there's a clear preference of linkers over fixed rate because break-even CPI has bottomed at 5% against actual inflation, which is near 7%. So why don't I stop there and turn it over to Jose.
Hi, thank you, Siobhan. I will cover LATAM corporates. So overall, we think that the asset class, EM corporates, it's still very compelling, offering both yield and spread compared to developed markets. However, yield and returns are very concentrated by regions specific sectors. Obviously, there's ample liquidity, and EM still suffers from the same, if you want to put it, condition, which is it's an asset class that's still under-allocated when you look at some of the largest pension fund players and other players. So that it's always a latent driver for excess returns in the years ahead. And very simple, just, you know, pick any index, but if you pick the JP Morgan SMBE broad diversify index with a spread right now a little bit tighter, close to 270, has significant spread versus, for example, the Barclays U.S. Corporate Ag Index, which is only at 100 over. So the case, particularly in terms of spread, it is there. I will go over five key themes that I see playing out in LATAM, and then over some of the positioning ideas that we have. First of all, as mentioned before, essentially China V-shaped recovery, with Bloomberg estimating a 2% growth in 2020 and 8% in 2021. This is critical for all EM and export-oriented countries, which many of those are in LATAM. However, the LATAM recovery in 2021 is more modest at 4% after a drop of 7% in 2020. LATAM commodity exporters will continue to benefit from China, including metals and mining, pulp and paper, meat packers. Those sectors have already outperformed in 2020 with 12% returns. But it will be interesting to see if some of those corps can still trade inside the 200-250 bips area. It is interesting, in LATAM, you have corporates still in the above investment grade, solid credit metrics, less than 3 cash flow, and of course, a very good, very interesting growth prospects in terms of earnings ahead, trading at 300 over from 250 to 300. So, is the line going to be crossed below 200? That's a interesting case going forward, particularly in the 10-year part of the curve of all those curves. In general, in terms of the LATAM recovery story, just consider that 80% and China, to close that point, consider that 80% of Brazil's exports go to China. Well, Mexico is a very different story. It's the opposite, as it competes with China for U.S. and European market in the manufacturing sector. So again, it is clear to track that relationship. Definitely some of that upside has been captured. I would say a good part of that upside has been captured. But again, seeing credits in the 250 area spread, IG in LATAM, I think it's something worthwhile watching. Then, as mentioned before, a U.S. Treasury curve widening and steepening, essentially based on, as mentioned, you know, by Stephen before, based on Bloomberg, average estimates for a 10-year is forecasted to move around 25 bips in a year time to 1.2% from existing 0.94%, and 30-year is expecting to widen from the existing 1.67 to 1.93, so close, almost the same, 25 bips. This is, of course, critical, affecting, you know, half of our market, or at least the index market. It is investment grade, so we definitely track and trace what's happening in U.S. Treasuries. But also, besides the widening, I think it's more important is the steepening. As we heard before, you know, we believe there are important, essentially, curve steepening expectations. And this affects LATAM IG corporates because they have the longest duration with higher coupons and steeper curves within EM. So I'll be very watchful of duration risk in portfolios, even after the recent uptick of around 20 bips in U.S. Treasuries in 30 years over the last 3 months. Still, interestingly, in 2020, long duration bonds delivered the best results in the region, in LATAM specifically. Third theme, it's essentially a rebound in transportation and infrastructure. Both sectors were massive underperformers in the fixed income area in 2020, with transport, mainly airlines, minus 20%, and infrastructure, mainly airports, minus 8%. They're very encouraging traffic numbers of passengers, cars, traffic, all already picking up in the majority of the region. And that once the vaccine reaches a critical mass in 2021, sector eventually will normalize. Main beneficiaries in transportation, in my view, are the airlines, GOL, Aeromexico, LATAM, Azul. And on the infrastructure front, many of the airports, right, like Tocumen in Panama, Aeroart in Argentina, Mexcat in Mexico, and also the many highway project finance bonds that where the desk is very active. And there are many of those names that we track closely, and we're seeing the improvement in the fundamentals. The fourth theme, it's essentially the fallen sovereign angels. Colombia in particular, where S&P and Fitch rate Colombia BBB- with negative watch on both, and then Moody's rates Colombia BA2 negative. A 2 out of 3 move to junk in Colombia will affect, essentially cheapen, a number of quasi-sovereigns and financials in Colombia that present no credit risk, in my view, beyond re-rating and index exclusion, creating noise and selling pressure. We have seen that in the past. And this includes some of the quasi-subs like Ecopetrol, Ocensa, and all the Colombian banks, which are sound and very well capitalized. I will also look, besides Colombia, at Costa Rica, as Siobhan already explained, with quasi-sovereigns like COSAIS and some of the Costa Rican-linked government banks, in the event that the sovereign has stress and a potential local rollover problem of its debt. The fifth theme, it's Mexico. Essentially, we're looking at a continued erratic economic policies at the macro level by the government, which leads to policy mistakes at the micro level. So the macro affects the micro here, and for example, potential contract cancellations and violations by Pemex, and to a lesser extent by CFE, as it just happened with the Braskem Idesa project, or the airport, the Mexican airport, back in 2018. On the hook of this thematic are various electrical and infrastructure companies. In most cases, this represents a long opportunity after the headline noise. So very watchful in general what's happening with all these credits links to Pemex and CFE and what happens itself with Mexico. Besides, you know, these five themes in terms of positioning and some of the ideas that we have a preference of LATAM high yield over IG, as IG outperformed high yield in 2020. Essentially, returns were 10% for IG. And 5% for high yield, year-to-date returns. So we see that high yield still offers an attractive spread compression, albeit picking your spots. It is worth highlighting, particularly in terms of returns, that November was essentially the outperformer month, where EM high yield had a 4.6 return out of the 6.1% return that the asset class had this year. So November was critical in terms of returns, spread compression, and that could reduce, you know, the expected returns in 2021. In IG, our top countries by value in spread today are Panama, which is more or less like 250 bips, Colombia, the same, 250, and Brazil, around 240. Mexico, to a lesser extent, for IG corporates, with at around 200 bips. And then all the other EM IG countries trade inside 200 over. So again, at least on spread, LATAM, that's where I would focus on the IG part. Still, our focus here has been more a little bit more on high yield. In terms of short term, I think it's very interesting. We have a preference for short-term callable bonds within the next 2 years. Many of the 2027 to 2029 maturities are callable in 21 and 22. Given the high coupons, low yields, above par trading, and very strong market appetite, we expect various companies active essentially in the redemption and refinancing market. We compiled a list of 30 bond targets, providing yields in between 2 to 4% that we find very attractive, you know, for 1 to 2 year paper. And we're very happy, you know, to discuss that that later, but we're tracking essentially a number of these bonds. In terms of specific, corporate specific, in terms of defensive and yieldy, I think both ASGN bonds, the hybrids 2029, the 2079, which are callable in 24 and 25 and trade to the call, are a relative safe credit. It is a relative safe credit with a yield to maturity of 4%. For a 3 to 5 year paper, this seems very reasonable in a company that I think has performed well and is transitioning into mostly into the renewable space. AS El Salvador, talking about El Salvador here, I think it's a strong credit in a difficult jurisdiction with yields in the mid 8%. We are constructive on El Salvador, as you heard from Shobarn, and it's interesting also to look at this particular corporate, you know, which is only a 2023 yielding 8%. AS Dominican Republic, also an interesting one, 2026 yield to maturity 7%. It is a strong credit with a country that has a sound macro, and the company has had a strong performance. Cognizant that this bond, you know, would have a split ahead, possibly in January, February, split into two separate bonds. But very happy to talk about it, and we sent a note in October regarding this particular trade idea. Then amongst the banks and a potential Mexican economy recovery story, I think it is best captured by Norte. This is the second or third largest bank in Mexico, a Mexican bank. And this is through the subordinated bonds, both the tier ones and tier twos. There are a number of them. It is interesting given the bank's strong metrics and expectations to be called in the next 4 to 10 years. The yields there are 5.5% to 7%. And basically from what you can hear publicly from management, the expectation is that these perpetual bonds are going to be called. The bank wants to stay active in the subordinated space. Again, for yields of 5.5% to 7%, I think it's just very difficult to find that, right? IG issuer in non-IG issuance with those yields. Finally, in Argentina, the main airport operator, AeroAr, recently restructured its bonds this year, with the next maturity being in 2027. Has supportive sponsors, I think, for those with more risk stomach and willing to look at least at one credit. In Argentina, AeroAr, it's an interesting one. That essentially concludes my presentation. I will pass it to Steven.
Thanks, Jose, and thanks to you and to Siobhan for that great material. So I'd remind everybody that on the right side of their webinar screen, there's a place where they can ask questions. You can just pop that open and type the question in there, and we will field that. But while we are waiting for questions to start rolling in, there is actually one already for Stephen Stanley, and this gets to the Fed, which we didn't really touch on, and then it occurs to me that there's a follow-up question, I suppose, for both Siobhan potentially and Jose. But to Stephen Stanley, the question is, with the rebound that Amherst Pierpont is clearly looking for last year, what do you expect the Fed's reaction function to be?
Right. Thanks, Steve. So clearly, if we get the scenario that I laid out before, that would be a big surprise to the Fed. And it would force certainly a reappraisal of the situation. Having said that, You know, right now the expectation both inside and outside the Fed is that the liftoff in terms of rates is not coming for a very long time, potentially as far out as 2024. And so I don't think that an actual rate hike is really in play for 2021, even if the economy outperforms significantly. However, there is an intermediate step that the Fed is eventually going to have to take, which is to taper and ultimately stop its asset purchases. And we know from the prior cycle with the taper tantrum that that can be a pretty sticky situation for the Fed. And I do think, if my scenario plays out, I do think the Fed is likely to need to start taking those steps in the second half of 2021. So, you know, I think that's is going to be a very key variable for the markets in 2021 is what the Fed is saying about asset purchases and whether they end up having to begin to curtail them once the pandemic looks like it's mostly passed.
So let me actually take that question and recast it a little bit for both Siobhan and Jose. We certainly look for the long end of the yield curve to rise over the course of the next year. And if the economy rebounds as strongly as we're expecting, then there's some chance that the Fed begins to alter its policy. What impact will that have on some of the credits that you're covering, especially dollarized credits, where effectively the cost of funds will tend to rise in line with the U.S. market? Maybe, Siobhan, you want to start us out on that?
Yeah, sure. So the Treasury risk is critical because we are spread product in EM. It really depends upon the extent of the normalization of the Treasury curve, right? If we have rising rates that are seen as disruptive, or the Fed behind the curve, or some a normalization process that disrupts equities and risk, then it could be problematic for all of EM and particularly the high yielders. But if it's an orderly process in terms of rising rates in the U.S., then it affects more the IG spread product and reaffirms, I think, this view that the EM high yielders should do well. And I should say kind of the niche sweet spot is probably the BB credits. We've had really strong performance of the BB credits, especially Domrep, and that gives you kind of that middle ground where you still get some carry and some high yield returns, but you don't have that same correlation trade to the same extent to equities as does the high yield, or to treasuries as is the IG spread product.
Jose, how about for your credits? Is that a material risk?
Yes, absolutely. The long end part of our curves has more duration. Emerging markets corporates have average duration, at least on the J.P. Morgan SMB index, of 7.8 years. That's pretty lengthy within EM. All those bonds are trading at very high dollar price, 120, 130, 140. We see potential significant risk of further curve steepening if that's the case, moving rates in the 30-year part of the curve and a lot of sensitivity in terms of convexity.
So here's another question, I guess, that's coming in from a client. This is for you, Siobhan, focusing on Ecuador. What are the incentives, if any, for an Ecuadorian government to default on restructured bonds?
You know, the only incentive would be a political agenda, because there are almost no cash flow savings. Like, the risk reward of a default of the next government would have to be kind of worst case scenario, Arauz is elected and, you know, it's a political strategy to vilify bondholders. But the trade-off is so bad, right? If you can default, get almost no cash flow savings, it won't be enough to resolve the budget stress, and you cut yourself off to accessing external credit. So it's really a lose-lose situation, and only really in the policy mix for kind of a radical government who pushes the country into crisis. If Lasso and the centrists, or maybe even Noboa could be in the mix, if a centrist government is elected, you know, they already have years of cash flow relief, the full term of the cash flow relief from this debt restructuring. So, you know, how could you rationalize it? You know, you could ask for debt relief, but you're not getting any cash flow relief. So the cash flow really kicks in after this next administration. So I think conveniently the bondholders can be put on the side, and it's going to be like Argentina, where you're looking at future debt repayment capacity based upon the policy mix, and they have some breathing room in terms of whether there's going to be a commitment to policies that can deliver stronger growth and can lower a structural fiscal deficit.
Okay, great. Again, I'd remind our listeners that there's a great opportunity to ask questions. We're getting a couple here. This looks like a very broad one. I guess, Siobhan, this probably applies to you. It applies to you as well, Jose. Talking for a moment about global trade, the next U.S. administration looks like it might be friendlier to global trade than the last, including the possibility of drawing down the use of tariffs. What effect, if any, will that have on the credits that you're following? Siobhan, why don't you lead us off, and Jose, follow after Siobhan.
Yeah, so I'll speak specifically about the high yielders and then maybe a bit about the IG credits. But Ecuador has already started the first phase of a bilateral trade agreement with the U.S., which is fantastic. I'm hoping that continues with the same momentum under a Biden administration. I also think trade and diplomatic relations with El Salvador will be critical. And also broader trade and immigration relations. So I think it's really a broader, I don't think it's specifically trade specific. I would take a broader view on U.S. bilateral relations. And I think migration and immigration issues for Central America, Caribbean are going to be relevant. And how that impacts, you know, could there be with a normalization and less stress in terms of the immigration policies, could that eventually allow for higher workers' remittances to Central America? Yeah, but I think it's a longer-term trend. I don't think there's an immediate impact. Mexico did so well, especially the peso initially, on prospects of a Biden win because the view was that would immediately improve trade relations with Mexico. But oddly enough, AMLO was one of the last, I don't even know if he's formally done it, to congratulate Biden on the win. So he seems to have worked out a quite reasonable working relationship with Trump. And they've already kind of solidified the trade relations between Mexico and the U.S. I think more interesting is if we have kind of far left influence with the Biden administration, how will that impact trade relations with Mexico in terms of, you know, labor relations or, you know, green initiatives, that type of thing. So maybe it could perversely be a bit stickier between Mexico and the U.S. But I think these are all very preliminary. I don't see any immediate shift in terms of trade or bilateral relations for most of Latin America. I mean, the hot spots are really Venezuela and Cuba, which are not tradable markets. But I hope that with Ecuador, we still have the same momentum in terms of the trade pact between the U.S. and Ecuador.
Thanks, Siobhan. Jose, how about for your credits?
Yeah, we'll separate it in blocks, right? Mexico already signed a new treaty, Mexico, Canada, and U.S., and that's the new framework that's going to rule the trade going forward. And strong U.S., meaning growth, it means also a strong Mexico in terms of the manufacturing sector, and there are a number of credits that we have that get affected by that. So that's really critical for Mexico and Central America. The South, meaning more the mining, agriculture, producing countries, starting with Brazil, have less to do with the U.S. It's more about the politics, the relations, is geopolitical, but it's really, Brazil is really about Asia, as I mentioned before. 80% of their exports go just to China, and it is critical really there how China does, how the China-U.S. relationship, how that affects into China growth of 8%. That's very important. And then commodities, right? The same will apply for mining countries, particularly Chile and Peru, that export mostly to Asia. So a subset of countries, it's really important, the policy. Another subset of countries have a different market, and the U.S. is probably a secondary, even a tertiary market in terms of commodity-driven exports.
Okay, fantastic. I'm sure there's more that we could touch on, but just looking at the clock, we've essentially run out of time. So I want to thank the speakers today, Stephen Stanley, Siobhan Morden, Jose Klicksberg, for their thoughts. I want to thank our listeners today for investing some of your time this morning in hearing our views on next year. If you want more detail, I'd encourage you to look at our Outlook 2021 issue of APS Portfolio Strategy that came out shortly before Thanksgiving. And I want to encourage you, please, to continue using Amherst Pierpont as a source of information on the issues in your portfolio that matter, and as a partner in your investing activities. So with that, we're wrapped up for this morning. Thanks again to everybody, and this concludes our call. Have a good day, and good luck in the markets.